Tonight is night of the new moon, the dark of the moon, December 19th, so heading towards the winter solstice, the darkest time of the year here in the Northern Hemisphere. In the customs and traditions of this part of the world, in Christian tradition, they have the festival of Christmas, festival celebrating the birth of Jesus, and then that's inherited some of the old pagan symbols of the evergreen tree covered in lights, the tree that is living through the dark and the cold of the winter, covered in living leaves, even though the cold and the dark time of the year is here. Even if we're here in Northern California and snow is not very common, still even on the Christmas cards we have the pictures of fir trees covered in snow. Are the images of this time, the customs of the time, having, you know, the trees covered with lights, and also here in the US people love to cover their gardens and houses also with colorful lights, lighting up the darkness. Also, this is in the Jewish tradition, the time of Hanukkah, there's also a festival of lights in the dark time of the year. Similarly, in the ancient Chinese tradition, the 24th hexagram of the I Ching is called the turning point, and this represents the winter solstice, the turning point of the year when the dark element reaches its maximum, and then it turns. It's also called the return of the light. So this time of the year is a natural way of recognizing the fact that the dark element reaches its maximum. It kind of gets as dark can be. Each day the light is getting shorter, the nights are getting longer, colder. But here it's been down below freezing at night, lots of, you know, frost on the ground, on the roofs in the morning. This is the coldest, the dimmest time of the year, but all these different festivals, different religious traditions point to the fact that, you know, the darkness, no matter how dark it gets, the light element is still there, buried within it. And then there's a turning point. There is the reappearance of the light, or that no matter what the signals are, the signs are that the darkness is getting worse and worse, or deeper and deeper, colder and colder. That these festivals, these symbols, are pointing to the fact that, you know, the light element is always there, buried within it, and even in the cycles of nature, then that light element starts to reappear, to reassert itself. The light appears in the darkness. Well, in terms of practicing Dhamma, in terms of our own lives and the use of meditation or reflection on these different symbols, yeah, this we can look upon these things in many ways. We can look upon them just as observing the patterns of the year and the cycles of nature, and just observing what's going on around us. But also, it can point to these useful qualities, or what goes on within us, that inside our own minds, our own hearts, things can seem to get darker and darker and darker. You know, each day getting the light element getting shorter, the mind getting heavier and heavier, more and more dense, and the ability to see clearly getting less and less, more and more darkness. And when we talk about darkness internally, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, the back of our eyelids when we close our eyes, but the darkness of the heart when we can't see clearly. This is our own internal vision, our own sense of understanding being clouded, being made dim by the veils of greed, hatred, delusion, the veils of self-concern, being caught up in things that we long for, things that we fear, things that we hate and push against. These are the obscuring qualities. It's not that you know, darkness has anything particularly wrong with it. Certainly the night can seem a much more sort of delightful and mysterious time and beautiful in its own way. But it's also, no one would disagree with the fact that it's harder to see. You know, that if you're walking through the forest here, finding your way along the trails, if you haven't got a flashlight, then it's much easier to get around during the daytime than it is during the night. Your foot doesn't go off the edge of the path in the daytime because we can see. At nighttime, if we haven't got a flashlight, then easily we miss our step and fall off the edge. So it can easily seem, you know, that when the heart is obscured by its darknesses, endlessly thinking about ourselves, what I like, what I want, what I fear, my memories, my past, my future, my projects, my opinions about myself, you know, opinions about other people, just being self-critical, critical of others. So easily the mind moves in these directions, hanging on to the things that we like, hanging on to the things that we dislike, creating images of, you know, those that we admire, people that we think are great and wonderful and we wish we were like them, or people that we think are terrible and bad and wrong, and the mind fills itself with kind of lists of all the bad things about this person and that person. Creating strong images of how good the past was, or how bad the past was, or what we long for in the future, my perfect place, my perfect home, my perfect monastery, where I'm going to go next year, the year after. These are all contributions to the darkness of the mind, filled up with I and me and mine, kind of self-concern, what I long for, what I fear, what I hate, what I love. You know, even though it can be kind of attractive or interesting or exciting at some level, these are the very things that make it impossible for us to see clearly, that kind of darken the heart and make it obscure and difficult. We get lost. You know, lost in our own self-images, our own ideas, our own loves and hates. It's so easy for us, isn't it? We get caught up and carried away. So these kind of images of the turning point, or the turning point, or the images of light in the darkness, the images of the evergreen tree, the tree which is still alive despite, you know, the degrees of frost and the coldness of the snow and the darkness of the nights, the things that stay alive. This is pointing to the fact that no matter how dark and lost the mind can become, no matter how caught up in a sense of, you know, I'm terrible, I'm stupid, I'm wrong, I'm bad, I'm hopeless, things are impossible and difficult, and why me, it's not fair, if only. Those kind of wailings and flailings of the heart, that these symbols point to the fact that there's an undercurrent of a real life, that there is, you know, light there in the darkness. No matter how dark it gets, there is the possibility, the potential, the actuality of light. And this is not just a kind of a fantasy, or not just kind of a problem, or just not just a sort of fanciful religious image or some kind of mythological tale, but this is the fact. This is when we apply ourselves in meditation, no matter how much the mind is caught up in what we're worrying about, what we're excited about, what we're afraid of, what seems bad and wrong, that we're upset about, or what seems unfair, or what we hope for, all the different kind of charges, there is that in us which can be aware of that. There is a quality of wisdom, of knowing, that can be fully aware and unconfused by what we fear, what we hate, what is kind of oppressing us, what is kind of burdensome and painful to us, what we long for that we haven't got, what we've got that we wish we didn't have, all those mistakes we've made in our past, all the things that we regret, all the kind of flaws we see in ourselves and others, all of the kind of reactive judgments that we make about ourselves, about the world, about the past, the future, the present. There's that in us which is aware of it, isn't there? there's this quality of a simple knowing awareness, a simple understanding that can see it. There is that which is watching it all, that which is able to step back just a little bit and say, oh, this is the feeling of hating, this is the feeling of loving, this is the feeling of wanting, this is the feeling of resenting, this is hoping, fearing, opinionating. This is what's happening. And in that stepping back, in that seeing, oh, this is what it is. This is a habitual view, a kind of a favorite way of seeing things. That's the light in the darkness, isn't it? That's the spot of light, the shape of color forming in the darkness. That's the spot of light which comes from our flashlight, which illuminates the path under our feet that helps us to find our way through the darkness. And even though we might be surrounded by darkness, you know, this is an image I'm very fond of, since we do so much walking through the darkness on the trails through the forest here. You don't have to illuminate the whole forest. You don't have to have like gigantic arc lights or kind of planes flying overhead that light up the entire forest in the darkness. All you need is one spot of light from your flashlight shining just before your feet. And that's enough to see by. You don't even have to have it illuminating 20 feet away. 50 feet away, just about 6 feet down below us, just where our foot is going to tread. That's all we need. That's the only kind of illumination that's necessary for us. We can have just that amount of light, and we can see where to put our next footstep. And there we are, we're fine. We can find our way. So it doesn't mean to say that when we are trying to deal with intense problems of habitual self-view or great habits of judgment or emotional reactivity, opinionating about ourselves, others, that we have to sort of dissolve the whole structures and habits of a lifetime or many, many lifetimes. It's not as though we have to dissolve every shred of attachment and compulsive identification. You know, and that in order for any kind of progress to happen, it's just rousing that amount of light within our heart, just like the flashlight that illuminates the few feet before us, just that amount of light to recognize, oh, this particular feeling, this particular longing, this particular fear, this particular hope, this particular sense of self, my thing, my idea, my project, my possession. Just the amount of light in the heart that says, oh, this is a feeling of I and mine. This is a habit of, oh, this is a feeling of owning. I really feel that these are, this is my kuti, my car, my shoes, my reputation, my past. It's that feeling, oh, this is just a feeling of myness and I-ness. That's what it is. It's a feeling. That's its shape. That's its form. It's like this. And just that amount of light is recognizing this particular feeling is insubstantial, is empty, is not self, is not who and what I am. Just that amount of light thrown on our experience, that's enough for us to be able to know where to put our next step. That's enough light. We don't have to have dissolved every shred of self-view, of conceit. We don't have to have totally conquered greed, hatred and delusion to make our way forward. Just that amount of light to know, oh, this is a habit, this is a love, this is a hate. That's what it is. I can see it, I can know it. That's enough for us to be clear about that. Oftentimes when we look at our own minds or we are confronted with some kind of difficulty in our lives, some kind of conflict between ourselves and a sibling or a spouse or someone that we live with, a parent or a child, some sort of ongoing difficulty, we think, how can I ever get beyond this? How can I ever work with this in an effective way? It seems so difficult, it seems so intractable, so unworkable. Or we can see that some deep-rooted issue in our life, some kind of ongoing habit, is so self-critical we feel that like we can never ever get beyond the place where we believe that we're basically a rotten, bad, stupid, helpless person. Something in us sort of sees that as being enormous and impossible to shift. We look upon our images of an arahant, we read the lives of the Buddha or the great sages, people like Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Chah, and it's impossible for me to ever get anywhere near that kind of perfection, that kind of purity of heart. And we can feel daunted or overwhelmed. But it's important to recognize we're not trying to kind of conquer every difficulty, or it's not possible for us to kind of attain that kind of absolute perfection and purity just sort of in a moment, in a week, or in a year. But it's by simply recognizing that we have this capacity to draw upon that quality of vision within us. We have the ability to see in this moment, and that's as much as we need to do. And then each step along the way, each time that we remember to draw upon that light within us and to illuminate the experience that we have, that strengthens our capacity to do that. That arouses and deepens the quality of faith that no matter how dark or difficult things get, and this is what this kind of imagery of this time of the year, that when things reach their maximum darkness, no matter how dark it gets, no matter how densely buried we are, no matter how much lost in the realms of struggle that the mind might be, that quality of vision is always there within us. That's always possible to draw upon. We just have to remember to do that. It was interesting in being in Egypt. One of the prevalent images in the Egyptian symbolism is that of the eye of Horus. Horus is the falcon-headed god who is the protector. He's the child of Isis and Osiris, kind of mother and father god. And Horus is the sun, and is the falcon. Is interesting enough that the circling of the falcon, which obviously in nature is the falcon looking for lunch, is taken to be the instead of being the sort of predatory eye, is looked upon instead as the protective eye that's circling around and overseeing, overlooking. And the symbol that is used today for a medical prescription, the capital letter R with the tail of the R with a diagonal line through it, that is not actually the Roman letter R. It's actually the Egyptian eye of Horus, symbol for the eye of Horus. That's what we use for a prescription. So that very protective eye, the eye which observes and which protects, is what we use as our symbol for the medical prescription. So, in a way, it's a kind of, if you sort of mesh the different symbols together, it's like that. And if we think of the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha, the truth of suffering, the truth of its origin, the truth of its cessation, and the path, that formulation derived from a kind of medical diagnosis from the time of the Buddha. So you have the ailment, the symptom of the ailment, which is dukkha, suffering. The cause, whatever is the cause of that, which is clinging or desire. Then the end of suffering, the prognosis, that yes, it's curable, but then the cure, the prescription, is the Eightfold Path. That's the prescription for the application of virtue, of mental training, concentration, and wisdom. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. This is the prescription that brings about the cure. So it's kind of interesting that in today's use, you go to any doctor and you get a prescription, then you'll get that R with the X, the RX symbol, the R with a cross through its tail, is the eye of Horus. And you can look upon that as being the eye of wisdom, which is the prescription. That is the cure. That's the medicine that's going to cure the ills. Now, these are just obviously just religious symbols and things that that you can look upon as being valid or invalid, but it's helpful and interesting to reflect upon them. to see, even in a sort of a practical use of what gets scrawled on the bottom of a doctor's slip, this very day and age, you can see comes from that, you know, what's the thing that's going to really make a difference? The eye. The eye of Horus, the protective eye that looks upon and observes, that kind of is able to see. And it's not just sort of emotional difficulties or struggles, but it's also our physical difficulties. You know, that when we're ill, when we have a headache, or we have some kind of ongoing illness, we have some kind of chronic diseases we're diagnosed with sort of incurable rheumatism or arthritis, or we have sort of cancer or some kind of ongoing ailment, we have migraines, or we have degenerative diseases of one kind or another, things that are physically maybe incurable or insoluble, that the prescription even in such physical difficulties or things that we see as being obstructive or burdensome to us, the prescription is still the same as looking upon our emotional difficulties or emotional struggles, is that eye, the overlooking eye, the circling eye, like the eye of Horus that gazes down from above and says, well, this is the body, this is the karma of the body. We're born, and so the body can only hold itself together and maintain a sense of a quality of health and orderedness for so long. You know, it's an incredibly delicate and intricately woven together system, and it can only work in a painless, efficient and comprehensive way for so long, and then bits stop working. You know, the older one gets, and the more that one's sort of friends and companions, you know, as the years go by, the subject of discussion between people is more and more, what kind of ailments, you know, which bit is not working now? You know, what they call the organ recital. Which organ is not working now? It's like, well, it's the eyes or the ears. Or, sorry, speak up. Why do people mumble so much nowadays? People, in my era, people used to be taught how to speak properly. Now everybody mumbles. Well, as we know, that people tend to mumble because the ear organ is starting to fade, or the eyes are going, or the memory's going, or the digestion's going, or mobility is fading. Just on this trip to Egypt, you know, a week ago today, I was up on top of Mount Sinai, where Moses received the tablets of the law from the great authority up on top of Mount Sinai. According to the legends of the Bible, then Moses climbed up Mount Sinai and got the Ten Commandments from Jehovah. Up on top of Mount Sinai, well, Moses didn't show up. But the Dhamma showed up in terms of Ajahn Sumedho saying, I think my mountain climbing days are over. He'd got a bit of a cold. Our trip to Egypt was very, very colourful and interesting, and it seemed like 100 different temples and shrines and tombs we went to, but it's pretty exhausting, and he came down with a cold and it turned into a nasty, phlegmy cough. And climbing up Mount Sinai in the middle of the night, set off at about 2 in the morning to climb up the mountain to be there for dawn. And about a quarter of the way up the mountain, he had to keep stopping and catching his breath and stopping, catching his breath, and slower and slower and slower. And we finally got to the first of the kind of coffee stalls and little caravanserais on the way up. And of course, you know, the local people, the Bedouins, no longer so much making their living trading through goods across the desert and with their camels. They now trade for service. It's a kind of like a camel taxi cab service, either at the pyramids or up Mount Sinai. So even though it was 2 o'clock in the morning, there was, you know, the taxis were out there looking for their fares. Says, camel? You want a camel? Very good camel, top class camel. So we got to the first coffee stall on the way up Mount Sinai, and Lumpur said, you know, I don't think I can go on. I'm holding everybody up. I can't do it. And he's someone who has incredible will and powers of strength and resolution, you know, awesome capacity. But there comes a point where will no longer applies. It's not just a matter of not having the willpower. It's a matter of the legs just don't go. You can't get enough oxygen into the body to make the legs work. And he realized this is it. The limit's been reached. I can't will the body up the mountain. It's just not going to go. And so, you know, he's 72 years old, and that's what the eye of wisdom was telling him, was that that's it. I can't walk anymore. So us having a collection of handy camels nearby and a few persuasive people, the choice was either was staying at the little coffee stall and waiting for everyone else to climb up the top and come back, or all of us going back, or some people, you know, staying there with him, or him going up on a camel. And Ajahn Vimalo being the most vocal and persuasive of the group, and finally persuaded Lumpur that a camel was totally allowable and appropriate. Cases of sickness, he wouldn't be offending the monastic rule. So finally, after some long and quiet and persuasive negotiation, Lumpur acquiesced to getting on a camel. And so up he went onto the camel's back. And when we asked, you know, is this a good camel? Oh yes, very good camel, very good camel. It's not going to bite him, is it? No, won't bite him. This is the BMW of camels. This is the BMW of camels. So he clambered on the back, and then leaning backwards, as one does when a camel gets up, so you can get tipped off. The camel rose up and carried him up all the way to the foot of the final ascent of 755 stone steps up to the top of Mount Sinai. But even riding on the back of the camel was not easy, because it was freezing cold. But finally, having got to the top, climbed all the 755 steps, there we were at the top of Mount Sinai. And Lumpur then, you know, reflected, I think my mountain climbing days are over. And he loves climbing mountains. He's one who really enjoys, delights in being able to do that. But then you realize, 72 years old, the body can only do so much for so long, and maybe this is it. And so wisdom is that which says, this is enough, this is what I can do. And knows when to yield, knows when to say, you know, the ego-based will, I want, I will, I can, I'm going to, that it can I all it wants to, I. But at a certain point, the ego loses its vote, no longer has any validity, no longer any real power or strength, and it can proclaim and protest all it wants, but it's lost its validity, it's lost its vote. And the eye of wisdom is that which knows, no, we've reached our limit here, it's not going to get better, you know, it's not going to change. The limit's been reached, okay? We have to adapt. So this is the eye that transcends, the eye that can really bring about the heart's release. In terms of Dhamma, you can say that the Dhamma is the light, the light of reality, the Dhamma Deepa, the light of reality, but the eye that knows it is the eye of wisdom, the eye of the Buddha. That quality of knowing, that awareness, is what is able to perceive that light. Because the light of Dhamma is always shining. It's just that often our eyes, the eye of wisdom, is closed. Reality is always the way it is. The Dhamma is always present. The way of nature is always present. It never changes. It's just that the eye of wisdom can be closed. So in our practice, in our element, our effort to cultivate the way to apply that, the healing prescription is a lot of opening the eye of wisdom, that Buddha eye that says, okay, go forward. Okay, there is no more forward. This is where I have to quit. And that whether we are quitting in terms of the legs carrying us up and we go by camel, or that even though sometimes a camel is not enough. I say, sorry, not even a camel will do here. This is it. This is where I stop. Just, you know, when our life reaches its end. And we can say, well, just try harder. Just determine. I'm not going to let death carry me away. That sometimes, no more vote. It's time to go. It's not a matter of not having the willpower or the strength or the faith. That's it. Game over. Act 5, scene 5, curtain. And wisdom is the eye that looks on and says, yes, this is it. This is time to let go. Nothing is being lost. Nothing is being destroyed. Nothing is being diminished here. So this is how we are able to transcend the world, to be able to not be confused or carried away, or seeing our sense of value or worth in terms of worldly things. Certainly it's nice to climb mountains, but sometimes we have to recognize, I can't climb anymore. And we find that whether we climb the mountain, or we're carried up the mountain by a camel, or we just don't climb the mountain. Like if those who've read the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, when the boy and his dad are riding on their motorbike and they go off on this side trip to climb a mountain, and they get a certain distance out to the base of the mountain, dad realizes, well, we're just at the base of the mountain, it's already getting dark, we don't have any warm clothing, we don't have any food, we should turn back. And the boy says, don't be a wimp, Dad, don't be a weakling, come on, we can do it. Dad says, no, this is time to turn back. If we climb, we're finished. So this is the time to turn back. So sometimes what on a worldly level can even look like failure or loss can actually be the right thing to do. We don't look upon our life and its success or its worth in worldly terms. But applying that eye of wisdom, then we know now's the time to go forward, now's the time to be still, now's the time to turn back. And then rather than thinking of those as success or compromising or failure, we realize that the real success, the real blessing, the real goodness and perfection comes from allowing the heart to rest in that quality of knowing, or awareness. And we see that because we're born, because the way the world is, there's light, there's dark, and there's twilight. Those are the changes of the world. And we don't look upon our worth or our value or the goodness of things just in terms of there being positive brightness and success, but seeing that which can be aware of light and dark and twilight, that is our true refuge, that is our the place of true blessedness, of perfection, of peace and clarity, is that which can be fully aware and open to the changes of the world, changes of nature, changes of our own life, changes of our mood, changes of our body. And to know it, to be aware of it, to be with it in its brightness and its success and its well-being and its degeneration and falling apart and ending, and it's also in its mediocrity. Just to know it all, to be aware of it all, to gather it all in, like the eye that surveys all from above. That's the medicine that truly heals, that truly brings the heart to the quality of wholeness, realizing its own innate wholeness and perfection. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Please take what is useful.